Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly. Marty Kendall is an engineer who seeks to optimize nutrition using a data-driven approach. His interest in nutrition began 18 years ago in an effort to help his wife Monica gain better control of her type 1 diabetes. But since then, he has worked to develop a systemized approach to nutrition tailored for a wide range of goals. Marty has been sharing his learnings at optimizingnutrition.com and has developed the Nutrient Optimizer and data-driven fasting to guide people on their journey of nutritional optimization. On this podcast, we're talking about optimizing nutrition and data-driven fasting, two areas of focus that Marty has found lead to impressive clinical outcomes like fat loss, reduced hunger, and improved metabolic health. Marty has actually managed to engineer and gamify the building of a healthier lifestyle. Experience it for yourself with one of his upcoming 30-day challenges, including the Data-Driven Macros Challenge and the Data-Driven Fasting Challenge, both beginning in January 2022. You can also learn more today with many of the free tools on Marty's website over at optimizingnutrition.com. Just before we get into this week's episode, I want to thank everyone who so generously supports this podcast on Patreon. Without your support, we wouldn't be able to keep this podcast independent and free of ads. So thank you. And just a reminder, as a Patreon supporter, not only do you have my eternal gratitude, but also you get some awesome gifts, including 20 to 35% discounts on all supplements we recommend when working with clients, which saves many of our supporters $50 to $100 a month over what they were previously paying on Amazon. So by supporting the podcast, they're actually spending less money each month. In addition to that, you also get access to our office hours, where my scientific director, Megan Hall, answers questions every week. You can submit all your own questions, attend live, as well as listen to all the replays covering everything from lipolysis to leg cramps. We've worked really hard to make sure that the bonuses you get are actually way more valuable than what you pay, whatever level you choose to support us at. So if you'd like to support the podcast and get access to the discounts and office hours, just head over to mbt.link and sign up there. Again, that's mbt.link. Thank you so much. Now let's head over to this week's episode with Marty Kendall. Well, Marty, thank you so much for joining me from Brisbane, Australia. Did I get that right?
Yeah, absolute pleasure. Great to chat again, mate. It's been too long.
Yeah, it's great to chat. I've been following your work for an awfully long time now. When did you get started with all this?
Oh, wow. Yeah, I started blogging maybe 6 years ago with Optimizing Nutrition. And then we connected through the Optimizing Nutrition Facebook page, which was a whole lot of fun back in the day. And then you had
back
the keto,
when I used to look at Facebook. That's like keto showing its age now.
Now you're hard to come by on Facebook.
And tell me what life is like in Australia right now. I couldn't help thinking that perhaps it's slipped into a totalitarian regime with these internment camps, like somebody you know tests positive for COVID and before you know it, you find yourself going on holiday for a couple of weeks.
I don't know, man. It's a bit of a crazy world, but we just try to lay low and avoid all the controversy. Like, as you said.
Are you rethinking the armistice? Do you think maybe it's a good idea to like bring back some more liberal gun laws and perhaps get yourself a cabinet?
No, we're okay. But we just try to lay low and avoid all the controversy. It's so exhausting to keep up with all the social media. Creates a pretty funky world, doesn't it?
Ah, well, I don't know either. See, I got off of that. No, as a Brit living in the US, I didn't understand this business of keeping a gun in your house until COVID came. And then I'm like, oh, shit, that's what it's for, right? Like, there's only certain things the government can do when there's 300 million guns in the country, right? Contrast Australia and Canada, not so much.
Yeah, just avoiding all that stuff and living my dream life. So
excellent. So tell us how you got into nutrition. I understand it was through your wife's experience with type 1, right?
Yeah. Married Moni 18 years ago. We started thinking about having children and she said, I think I need to get my blood sugars under control. Hardly understood what that meant. And we found a doctor that helped us and got two amazing, lovely, everybody loves the kids, but I think ours are pretty special and great kids who are 15 and 16 or 17 now and just thriving. But maybe 10 years ago, I sort of started getting into Rob Wolf and I looked back on a document back then when I was starting to say, hey, what can our family eat to optimize our nutrition for weight loss for me and for blood sugar optimization for Moni? And then just kept diving down the rabbit hole of Rob Wolf. And then we're talking about, Jimmy Moore and keto and low carb and then found that didn't work for everybody all the time. So then jumped into nutrient density and satiety. And just as an engineer by day, I've just tried to understand everything I can, a bit like you, through numbers. How do we quantify this to make sense of it? Because nutrition is all about belief and basically the new religion that we all follow devoutly. But vegan, carnivore, they're all opposites, but what are the commonalities that make them work? And how do we quantify that to cut through the dogma for people who actually need optimal health, need to improve their health, like for people like Moni? So yeah, it's worked out well. Had a whole lot of fun, met a lot of amazing people like you. And yeah, Moni's quality of life is vastly different in terms of energy levels.
Oh, really?
Levels and
so subjectively,
and,
quality of life is better. So yeah. It's not just like, oh, my hemoglobin A1c is...
No. Happy wife, happy life. And yeah, my life is much happier since we've dialed it in. And occasionally when lately our closed-loop CGM system has gone on the blink and the battery ran flat in the transmitter and we've got to wait for a week. And if the blood sugars go high, her whole quality of life is in the toilet again. So it just reminds you of how important this is for us.
Yeah.
And yeah, it made a lot of friends and shared it with people who are benefiting from it as well.
Okay. Imagine what it's like for the little kids with type 1.
And yeah, I keep thinking of what could Bonnie's life have been like if she'd had the knowledge that we have now when she was 10. There's just still no great information for people mm-hmm. with type 1 diabetes on how to manage insulin and blood sugars and food and diet. Well, it's just so tied back to the food pyramid and the USDA dietary guidelines, and they just can't deviate from that. So yeah, not that you need to be radical, but it's just understanding all the different moving parts of nutrition and how to dial them in to get stable blood sugars and reduce insulin and et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, a whole lot of fun.
So what drew you towards nutrient density as something to optimize? As you just mentioned there, there's so many things, right? There's been this macronutrient war that's been going on for some time. And then, as you mentioned, there's also the vegan versus carnivore thing. And then there's the kind of the war on insulin as well, you know, like the lower the better. And I don't think any of those things have been particularly helpful.
No.
Whereas the nutrient density is an argument that I can get behind. So, but what was it that drew you towards nutrient density?
Fascinating journey. I initially heard Jason Fung talk about the food insulin index, and it was a bunch of research done in 1998 at the University of Sydney, just down the road from, well, not really just down the road, about 12 hours drive in Australia. And they looked at the different foods that affected the short-term insulin response in healthy people. And I downloaded that, and there was only like 38 data points, and I found another 130 that they've done since and plotted a regression through it and found that, yeah, you need, obviously, for non-fiber carbohydrates, you need insulin in the short term, and then protein requires insulin as well, about half as much as carbohydrate, and then fat doesn't require as much insulin in the short term. And then sort of reverse engineered that to say, hey, what should Moni eat to reduce her insulin dosing to get her off the roller coaster? So, but when you do that analysis, you find that really that's just largely like butter, olive oil, refined fat, bacon, which is keto. So I got really enthused about keto. But then the more I dug into that, I realized that these foods contain very few nutrients. And then I had Rob Wolf and Matt Lalonde. He did an amazing presentation a long time ago about nutrient density. They just sort of bashed out in a weekend. That was this work of genius. And I thought, Matt, why haven't you continued to kick this ball down the road? It's incredibly powerful work to quantify nutrient density. And I went, okay, I'll do it myself, and downloaded the USDA food database and created my own nutrient density ranking factor, basically like Google has ranking factors, nutrient density is a ranking factor, and just kept experimenting with it to try and make more sense, because there's a few things in Matt's system that were, you know, if you don't put a limit on how much weighting you give to protein, you know, you just get liver and beef and everything that's just incredibly nutrient dense, because proteins, amino acids, easy to come by in the food system. And then you've got Joel Fuhrman's nutrient density approach that basically was avoided amino acids and omega-3 and all the things that were inconvenient for the plant-based vegan world. So I just kept refining the nutrient density and then basically turned it into a multi-criteria analysis to say, okay, you've got satiety, nutrient density, and insulin index. And based on your goals, you need to weight different factors to different degrees. So yeah, that's sort of the basis of our system. And so if you're someone who has type 1 diabetes, you can choose foods that stabilize your blood sugars. But if you're somebody who's, you know, wanting to get shredded, then a really high fat keto diet is not going to be the only thing you need, because it tends to avoid protein and et cetera, et cetera. So.
And what do you think the evidence is for a nutrient-specific satiety? So I get the nutrient density argument, but in simplest form, right? There are certain micronutrients that appear in our food, and if we don't get them, we die, right? Like bad, or at the very least, very bad things happen. And so you need to think about those things. when making food choices.
Mm.
But as you, me, and everybody listening really cares about is body composition
yeah.
and fat loss.
And optimal health and vitality.
Yeah, and optimal health and vitality. And so, but specifically around the satiety, do you think there is evidence for nutrient-specific satiety?
Yes, is the short answer. And I've done a whole bunch of fascinating work lately to look at it. And Rubenheimer and Simpson from University of Sydney, two amazing professors, entomologists, started looking at bugs and a range of species and showed that we all eat until we get enough protein. So if you've got a low protein environment, you'll keep chasing more food until you get enough protein. And my analysis sort of always has inferred that more nutrients per calorie leads to greater satiety as well. So if you've got a nutrient poor diet, you continue to eat more. So about a month ago, we did a data dump out of Nutrient Optimizer of 125,000 days of chronometer data from 32,000 people. So you've got this macronutrient and micronutrient data from a large amount of people. And then we're able to actually analyze that and see that, yeah, protein is really powerful for satiety, but we also seem to have a satiety response to minerals and to some extent vitamins as well. And, you know, as long as they're not in fortification or supplementation, because just dumping a whole lot of taking a B vitamin pill or having fortified foods may not be ideal. So yeah, that's an interesting rabbit hole to jump down as well.
Yeah, I can see how it may not be ideal because maybe we don't know all the micronutrients that appear in food, right? Like I feel like they keep finding ones. Like how old is K2 is not even that old, right?
Yeah, exactly. And choline is similar.
Yeah, exactly. It's really a B vitamin, but they were done naming the B vitamins by the time they got to, they found choline. Right?
And they went, yeah, it's not really essential, but we can't make much of it. So we'll make it an essential nutrient. But I ran the multivariate analysis as suggested by Rubenheimer and Simpson, and it did really show that it's not just a random association. We do have a highly statistical satiety response to the foods that contain more, particularly potassium came out as the strongest response. It just seems that, yeah, we crave sodium to an extent, but because we live in a world that we need to balance potassium and sodium, we seem to crave more foods that contain more potassium and keep on eating. But if we can find a way to get more potassium per calorie, we eat a lot less. And the same is true for calcium and sodium and a range of the vitamins and minerals in a really powerful way. So yeah, like you said, it's not a matter of let's make a supplement stack that contains all these. It's that let's isolate the foods that contain more of the nutrients that I currently need. And that will also contain not just all the other essential nutrients, but all the non-essential nutrients that we don't understand yet.
And how do you control for other factors there? So one thing you reminded me of there when you started talking about potassium is that you know, potassium is generally lost in highly processed foods, right? So potassium generally lives inside of cells.
Yep.
And when you break down the cell wall, the potassium is lost into whatever liquid the food is currently suspended in. And maybe you dump that liquid at some point along the food processing pathway. And so you end up with highly processed food that's very low in potassium and perhaps high in sodium because you added sodium for some reason.
Because it tastes good.
As a preservative or something like that. So is our brain somehow seeking out the potassium, or is it that just we're passively over-consuming calories because we're eating so many processed foods?
Yeah, two things there. We've got the multivariate analysis that really did strongly show a statistical, significantly strong satiety response to foods that contain more potassium and calcium and sodium. But at the same time, like, nutrition is really complex. Micronutrients are really complex and vitamins are degraded by heat and high pH, et cetera, et cetera. And yeah, we do lose minerals when we drain our animal foods and we don't eat raw animals that we just hunted and killed with all the blood in them. But I suppose what we've done is taken 125,000 days of data from people, how they currently log it in chronometer. So it's like apples for apples. You don't know exactly how much food is of that nutrient is lost in it or whether it's 100% bioavailable and all those rabbit holes that you go down. But if you're measuring how do people measure their food versus, you know, what are the targets we want to set, you can say if you're measuring your food, this is the sort of target you need to set in chronometer to target greater satiety if that's what you're after. But if on the reverse, if you're a endurance athlete who just needs to jam in more food, then the priority is getting more energy from fat and carbs. And you talk in your podcast all about these people who are suffering reds from just not getting enough energy. So 80% of the population is needing to lose weight, but you can reverse the scenario to, for people like yourself who just need to pound out the kilometers on the bike because they're obsessed with it and but still need to get enough nutrition in their diet. So it's like a multivariate analysis, multi-criteria analysis that we can use to create a food selection. Here are the recipes, here are the foods that suit your particular goals, context, circumstance.
Yeah, red S is tricky because I think often it's a psychological problem, right? Is you can't solve it by cramming more food down the hatch, right? There's Herman Ponson's been really good on this, that total energy is constrained. And, you know, if you blow the whole budget on locomotion, then shoving more down the hatch doesn't work. You just can't process it. And so all you can really do is reduce volume.
Yeah, and creating energy density.
So you mentioned sodium, potassium, protein. Are there any other macro or micronutrients where there's a nutrient-specific satiety? Like, does anybody get hungry for vitamin B12, for example?
Well, interesting. Yeah, particularly vitamin B9, B1, B3, we seem to see a statistically significant satiety response to a lesser degree to those nutrients as well. And it's interesting in the food system, back in the 60s, they did some analysis where they looked at pigs who are fed. They used to feed them, here's the grains and here's the alfalfa and we'll let you out on pasture occasionally, but it's much more convenient to jam the pigs in the barn and just feed them grain. But they got sick and stopped growing and their skin got really awful and they weren't great. But what they realized is, you know, if you gave the pigs alfalfa in the barn, that helped and that gave them the B vitamins, the micronutrients to help them keep growing. But then they went, hey, what if we just fortify the grain product and just give them those foods? So I have to keep on eating. And they just kept on chowing down on that food and they grew amazingly because they've got all the nutrients they need. And in a way that they no longer crave the alfalfa. And it seems like 10 years later, we started ramping up the fortification of breakfast cereals and everything else. And it just seems now we're continuing to chow down on these nutrient-poor foods that are fortified. So we continue to A, crave those foods, and B, we no longer crave the meat and veggies and seafood that naturally contain those nutrients. So it's great for marketing. I don't think it's necessarily designed entirely for, altruistically to help our health. It just helps us continue to eat those foods that would otherwise we get bored of because they don't contain the nutrients we need.
And so tell me, how did you get into creating your own software, the Nutrient Optimizer? Why were you dissatisfied with the tools that were currently available? You mentioned Chronometer there, right?
Yeah, Chronometer is great because it shows you what's in your food and all these little bars that you say, oh, I am getting enough B1 and B9, but I'm not getting enough calcium or magnesium. But what do you do with that information? How do you actually utilize that great data? There's nothing to tell you, oh, yeah, I'll take a supplement, or maybe I'll find your Google high vitamin C foods and it'll come up a list of foods and then you'll go, okay, what do I eat to get my B12? But really what you need is, what are the foods that contain the nutrients that I'm getting less of? Let's pick 3 or 5 nutrients and prioritize the foods and meals that do that. And to me, it was sort of obvious as an engineer. It's just a multi-criteria analysis to say, what are the foods and meals to give you those nutrients? And nobody was doing it. I started doing it in a spreadsheet, and then Alex came along and said, let me help you program that. I can do this. And it's just grown from there over the last 4 years of continually iterating to take people's Chronometer data, import it, and say, here are the foods and meals that you need to prioritize next week. And then sort of an iterative process. Once you've nailed those current nutrients, you can then move on to the other nutrients to continue to optimize your diet.
So what was the point that you were forced to make a change? Were you doing this spreadsheet for someone other than yourself?
Yeah, I was started to do it for a few people and it was just taking 2 hours per person. It's just completely not scalable at that point and going insane doing that. It's like, I love doing this. I'm really passionate about it, but I'm not going to save the world if each time takes 2 hours. But yeah, you can automate it like you've found. You can automate the process and it becomes very, very, very scalable and very implementable. Uh-huh. So since then, we've continued to try and simplify it and refine the software as well as the information. It's always, like we were talking about before, just a matter of simplifying it to the point that people can implement it and make a tiny change each week rather than trying to rip off the Band-Aid and change everything all at once. It's what are you currently eating? And let's find a few foods and meals that will help you move a little bit down the track. It's not, here's a whole new way of eating that's completely foreign to you at the moment. And in 2 weeks, once this challenge is over, you'll hate it and revert back. It's like, let's continually step change your diet to give you the nutrients you need, which then provide the satiety and vitality and mental clarity and performance improvements. And then you get addicted to chasing it. And it's amazing how people get obsessed with chasing, you know, the optimal nutrient score. You put up a leaderboard of nutrient density and people go mad for getting to the top of it and competing. It's like, if they can do it, why can't I? And I thought I knew all about nutrition. It's great. You gamify nutrition. It's rather than all of nutrition's about what you shouldn't eat. Let's avoid cholesterol, yeah, and saturated fat and sodium and plants or animals. But it's like, let's reverse this and gamify it to say, hey, let's prioritize the foods your body needs and the nutrients that it needs to thrive. And if you gamify that, it's really cool.
No, that's great. I wonder if you're going to do age groups. Like, I wouldn't mind submitting my kids to their respective age groups. You know, they had liver for breakfast. The US Wellness meets liverwurst, which is maybe cheating. That's not like, you know, you put a cow's liver in a pan and fry it up. That's a very different.
And Ivy smashes $20 worth of oysters that are sitting by the sounds of it.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Great. Yeah, for lunch they had, it wasn't $20 worth. It was the Crown Prince cans variety, which to me tastes like fishy hockey pucks. But the kids will smash
they
like
love
a hot can of that each.
They love them. Yeah, on that, there's a fascinating study from the 1930s, Clara's kids. I don't know if you've heard about it, but this nutritionist basically took over an orphanage with recently weaned kids that had no influence from what's normal to eat and what tastes good, and they hadn't been exposed to modern frankenfoods. And this gave them, I think it was 38 different natural foods, from milk to, you know, I think they were even brains and liverwurst and all these random Western A price sort of eccentric things. And they just, every day was different, and they just kept on going out and finding the foods that they needed. And there's also stories of kids that have self-selected the foods that will cure this or that, and they just eat it till they've got enough, and then they stop and move on to other more normal foods. So our modern society is so polluted by what's normal to eat, and once we've been eating a certain way for a certain time, we get into habits where, you know, those liver and the oysters are really weird for most people, and they hate them. But
it's a cultural thing.
Yeah. Oh, and an entrained taste thing to an extent too. So yeah.
And I've seen the opposite too. We spent some time with this kid once. I think he must have been about 3 or 4, would be my guess. And, you know, we were there for a couple of hours in a park, and this kid did not stop eating the whole time. He was a vegan kid and was just pushing food down like it was going into a juicer. It was unbelievable. You know, celery sticks and carrots and pretzels and nuts and just constantly, you know. So you cannot get my kids to eat in general. Like, it's really hard to get them to sit down and eat because they're just like so full of energy. They just want to be doing stuff all the time, right?
And they're full of oysters.
They're like climbing up down trees and stuff. This kid just sat there the whole time. The kid was definitely a beast too.
Wow.
And it did make me wonder about, you know, the protein leverage hypothesis. Is this kid's just going to keep on eating until they find some protein, and then eventually they'll stop, right? But until then, it's just going to keep pushing food into the juicer.
Yeah, it's a double-sided coin because, like, theoretically, a whole food plant-based diet can be fairly nutrient-dense. You're going to struggle to get B12 and omega-3 and a bioavailable protein. Who just sits there and eats the celery and the spinach and the sweet potatoes, and who only eats that in the vegan world? It's only a very small fraction that those people tend to be very lean. But what does plant-based mean? Plant-based completely includes refined oils and refined sugars and refined flours that is just the formula for modern hyperpalatable foods. So if you just say we should go plant-based or vegan, it just leaves the door open for everything in the center aisles of the food of the supermarket that is modern trash, that is nutrient poor, protein poor. And I've done sort of, let's reverse engineer the protein leverage hypothesis to see how much more we'd all eat if, in calorie terms, if we just reduce protein. And yeah, it's quite scary. If we all went plant-based, then we're probably, unless we're sticking to those foods that are impossible to overeat, the celery and the carrots and the etc., you just end up overeating. And unless you're chaining people down or putting them in a cell, they're going to find those, the pretzels and the donuts and everything else, because they're just so bloody hungry.
Exactly. And it's probably also great for a restaurant, right? What does a restaurant care about? They care about taste and they care about price, and that's it.
They don't care about
your health or anything long term. Those are two things. So vegan is like not a restriction at all. That's like probably optimal for a restaurant business, right? All the grains are super cheap and the processed oils.
Yeah, and now they've got plant-based green, chicken nuggets in inverted commas, and it must be cheap as because protein's expensive and profit margins are low, so it's great for everybody except the humans that eat it.
Yeah, the long-term health of the humans who are consuming it. So walk me through the nutrient optimizer then. So am I still using Chronometer under the hood, or how does it work?
Yeah, you can just track your food in Chronometer, and then that connects into Nutrient Optimizer, and that will give you we track your weight and your blood sugar and a bunch of other metrics that'll help you decide whether you need a higher satiety or a lower satiety diet. If you're looking for therapeutic keto, you're an athlete trying to perform a massive amount of activity. I mean, therapeutic keto can be great for kids with epilepsy who need more energy, but most people just need less energy, more satiety, more nutrients per calorie. So for most people, it's just, what are you currently eating? And here's some foods and meals that will help you fill those gaps. And we've spent the last 3 years creating 460 NutriBoost recipes. So they're optimized for nutrient density, but then with all the macros and micros quantified, we can then say for you this week, because you're lacking potassium and sodium and vitamin B3 or whatever from food, here are the recipes that you should prioritize next week. And as you keep tracking, it'll keep on updating dynamically those foods and recipes that are recommended for you each week. And then we guide people through that. We've been running a nutritional optimization masterclass for the last 3 years. And going forward in 2022, we're changing that into a data-driven macros and data-driven micros course. So most people, we realized delving into micronutrients is a really deep rabbit hole if they don't understand what protein, fat, and carbs is and how to dial it into to suit their goals. So the first step is let's get your macronutrients in the right range, and then we can start worrying about micronutrients, which is sort of the icing on top of the cake that really takes it to the next level of satiety and performance and mental acuity and clarity.
And how have you been finding the compliance? You know, if you're running a masterclass, how easy are people finding it to make the changes that are recommended by the software? Our personal experience at MBT, we found protein to be continuously challenging. Over and over again, I speak with clients and you say, okay, well, let's back of the napkin. Yeah. Do you think you're getting 1.5 grams per kilo of body mass of protein per day? And they're like, no, you know, I'm not. You know, I've heard you and Megan talk about that so many times. And Megan mentioned it specifically on three of our early calls. But
she had a really great podcast on protein. She absolutely nailed that. Yeah, we get a lot of people coming in from a low-carb keto background historically because that's the space I've occupied. And people think they're getting enough protein and, you know, they've got they can eat fat to satiety. But once they actually start tracking it, like you said, they might be getting enough protein, but with that protein comes a lot of fat and more fat that they need. So that's sort of the aha moment of how do I get protein without excess fat? So that's sort of the first step. And like we were talking about before, it's not a matter of here, just eat this chicken breast and broccoli and cod for the next month. You just need to start with where they are now and let's bump up the protein a little bit and bump up your dial down your fat a little bit next week. And if you're making progress, great. But if you're not making progress, let's bump it up a little bit more and slowly tweak it. And you sort of continually change the guideposts slowly, like the carrot in front of the donkey that just keeps moving forward a little bit at a time. And that's sort of what we've found most beneficial to build habits. But when people do it in a community setting where everybody else is doing it, they say, yeah, okay, if other people can do it, I can do it. It's worth tracking. It's worth changing what I eat to continue to improve my nutrition.
That's great. And so how have the results been? Do you have any data? I can't resist asking that because you have software. People are quantifying stuff. So you don't
actually
have
tons.
Objective data to show people improving?
Yeah. Yeah, no. And we've got every masterclass we come out with people losing a lot of weight, which is really good. But it's through not just sheer willpower, it's from changing what they eat, which provides greater satiety, which is therefore sustainable. If you just eat less calories of the same old shite, then eventually you're going to be craving more food. But if you dial in the nutrients, if you improve the nutrient value of what you're eating, then you've got a much better chance of you formed new habits that are sustainable and then can continue. And you can't unsee once you've seen the food you eat in terms of the macro and micronutrients quantitatively. You can't go back to eating the same thing without thinking, I know what I'm eating and I'm, you know, it's a slow suicide.
I think it was Ted Nyman that first pointed out to me that you can't choose how much you eat, but you can choose what you eat, right? So if you choose wisely on the foods, then the amount that you eat is subconscious, subterranean. You don't need to think about that. In fact, if you do think about it, you'll probably just mess it up.
Ted and I are on the same wavelength in so many ways. He's a great friend. And it's so important. People think that, just eat less calories. And it's true. Eating less calories will help you lose weight. But how long can you maintain that for? And the studies are littered with evidence that people can't just use willpower to eat less of the same trash. They need to dial in what they eat. And if you want to cut through the dietary dogma and religion and belief system, let's dial in the micronutrients, because we don't care if you eat more plants or more animals. You just need micronutrients from your food. And people quickly find how they can progressively optimize their current diet to keep moving forward a little bit.
And who are these people that are coming into your masterclass? And is it all just fat loss they're after, or is it other things too?
A lot of diabetes management. So we'll look at your carb intake. If your blood sugars are elevated, dial back the carb intake to maintain healthy, stable blood sugars, but not flatline blood sugars. There's a lot of nutrition enthusiasts who just have been reading the blog about nutrient density for 5 years and go, I want to do this, I want to dive down, and they just keep coming back again and again. We nutrient optimizer can be dialed in for athletic performance or lean bulking or gaintaining sort of thing, but there's more people in the weight loss nutrient density focus.
What was that word you just said? Gaintaining.
Gaintaining. Yeah, it's a Lewis Velocinior term that he uses to say, you know, I'm going to continue to grind. Most bodybuilders sort of bulk and then cut and bulk and then cut, but whatever he's doing, he's got it right because he.
Oh, you think so? Has he tried eating some carbs to see if he makes even more gains? I'm convinced that he wouldn't.
It's a little bit, I think, but not too much.
Okay.
He is Mr. Keto Gains.
And so tell me, recently you've gotten into data-driven fasting. How did that come about?
It was an idea we came across 5 years ago. There was a study in University of Auckland where they looked at hunger training based on blood sugars. And after spending 18 years looking at my wife's blood sugars daily, it just made a hell of a lot of sense. So what they did is basically got people to wait until their blood sugars hit a certain level until they ate. But the problem with that is it wasn't adaptive to the person or their progress. So what we've done is taken basically using your blood sugar as a fuel gauge, and it's an immediate fuel gauge of whether you need to eat. If your blood sugars are high, like if Moni's blood sugars, my wife's blood sugars are through the roof, eating is sort of the worst thing you can do. But once the blood sugars come crashing down, especially if she's taken too much insulin, there's nothing stopping her demolishing the cupboard or the fridge with that extreme hunger at that point. So hunger relates to blood sugars quite strongly. And one thing that triggered me about the fasting culture and community is it's like more is better. But every time I fasted for days on end, you'd just be the same thing, hoovering the fridge and completely hungry and making very, very poor food choices at that point. So what data-driven fasting does, it just lets you get your blood sugars a little bit lower than what's normal for you. You validate your hunger with your blood sugar, and then you eat again, and you quickly find what you eat really affects your blood sugar, not just in terms of how much it rises, but how long it takes to fall back below your normal again in your below your trigger and ready to eat again. So it's, you know, some people say it's really data-driven eating, and it is in a way, but it just guides people to eat when they need to eat, two or three times a day rather than all the time.
I'm amazed that works at all. I'll be honest, using blood glucose as a fuel gauge, like I'm immediately thinking about, I did a little 15-minute BFR workout before I hopped on this call. And I know that that probably sent my glucose higher than my lunch did. You know, I had some sausages for lunch. Like there won't really be much of a bump in my glucose at all from that, but the workout will definitely do it. So what do you do if, you know, you get a bit stressed out at work or something, or a crap night of sleep? Then that's just going to blow the whole thing off.
Yeah, totally. You've got to educate people to understand what the other things that affect your blood sugars, monthly fluctuation in hormones and exercise. Intense exercise will blow your blood sugars up a little bit as your liver dumps glycogen into your bloodstream to fuel that activity. Lower intensity, MAF type workouts will lower your blood sugars. Stress, poor sleep will also factor in, but we've got a little tag when you take a blood sugar and say, hey, my blood sugar is a bit more elevated than normal because I just had a workout, or it's that time of the month for a female, then they can tag it, it'll bump up the trigger a little bit. But you're talking about results. The results of the whole data-driven fasting thing have been even better than just focusing on nutrient density and the masterclass. It's just a really guided way of dialing in meal timing, smashing snacking, and stopping people eating fasting for so long that they get so hungry that they make really poor food choices and their metabolic rate declines. So for most people, it works really, really well. But eventually, what you eat becomes critical. So you've got to start thinking about, are you getting enough protein for satiety? And my blood sugars are stable and flat line, but because I'm eating so much fat, my blood sugar stays elevated for a very long time. So they learn to dial back their fat so the blood sugar can drop below trigger again sooner and the like. So yeah, it's just a fascinating little learning microcosm that data-driven fasting and data-driven macros and micros sort of all work together.
Yeah, I wonder what it'd be like if you were to train people to pay close attention to their internal signals of hunger, right? So this idea of mindful eating. Mm. I think it was Eric Helms pointed out to me on a podcast interview that I did that, you know, the people like the anorexic and somebody who's passively overeating processed food, they're kind of the same in that they're not really paying close attention and trusting their internal hunger cues, yeah. Right? Like they're maybe continuing to eat for hedonic reasons, or they're starving hungry and they're ignoring that, thinking, yep, oh no, I've already eaten too much food, I can't possibly eat anymore. And so the solution in both cases is actually to retrain that person to listen to the internal sense of hunger. And I wonder if, you know, the glucose meter is just another, I mean, I know it's internal in the sense that you're measuring something that's internal to your body, but you're still like making decisions based on some external factor like that.
Yeah, totally. And that's why I'm a little bit anti-CGMs for data-driven fasting, because people use their blood sugars as a, okay, I'm below trigger, it's time to eat, rather than I feel hungry, I'm not sure if it's time to eat, I'll validate with the blood sugar. And people quickly learn to correlate the sensations of hunger with their blood sugar. So that's why we call it hunger training, because you're then learning, I feel lightheaded, I've got a grumbly tummy, I feel cold. You're actually learning those sensations of true hunger that then, once you're not using a blood sugar machine anymore to guide that, you can then go, yeah, I understand what true hunger is because I've learned to correlate it with my blood sugar. So yeah, it's not just about refilling when your fuel tank is low, it's about validating your hunger.
That makes perfect sense. I think a lot of the athletes listening will recognize that from the heart rate monitor, right? Like once upon a time, it made sense for me to wear a heart rate monitor so I knew what hard felt like, but now maybe it's been too long, actually. Maybe I could use wearing one again for a while, but I'm pretty sure I could tell you what my heart rate is within a few beats at any point during a 2-hour ride.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, but you've got to train it with a bit of quantitative data initially, and then you want to get out there and live in the free world and not always be tied to your calorie tracking app or your blood sugar app or your CGM or your Oura Ring or whatever. You know, you can over quantify things to the point that you lose touch with your actual true sensations of your bodily sensations, which you need to be in touch with.
And you talk to people about exercise. You know, I was quite convinced by Herman Ponser, his argument again that, you know, there's lots of reasons to exercise, but weight loss isn't one of them. Like it's a thirsty diet. So you got that nailed there, right? But you could also argue, and maybe I've heard Ted talk about this too, is that exercise is fasting in fast forward. Right? And maybe I don't need to be hungry for 5 days. I could just go for a 2-hour bike ride. I'll get the same effect, right? And then I can eat afterwards.
Yeah, no, we definitely encourage exercise, but in the data-driven macros, we don't say, you know, your Garmin said you burnt 1,000 calories, you can have that box of donuts afterwards, because that never works out well, because there's so many inaccuracies in that. But yeah, we do try to train people to, hey, if you want to drop your blood sugars, go for a brisk walk. If you're going to do a massive high-volume gym workout, your blood sugar is going to spike and you're going to feel hungry after, and it's okay to eat, maybe prioritize your protein and your main meal around that workout, so you're not going to be waiting 5 hours later and then completely hammering all the food you can get your hands on.
And are you finding that people, any benefit they get, it lasts over time? You kind of already hinted at that a little bit, but you know, I've seen data from some of our clients when they've done a 5-day water fast, say, and sure, there's a tremendous loss of weight, but I mean, it just seems to return back to baseline, and it comes back to baseline so quickly. It makes me wonder what it was that they lost, you know,
what they regained.
Like, I have no idea what that's doing for their body composition over time.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that we sort of designed data-driven fasting for, is that culture that says, you know, if I fast X hours, I get this level of autophagy, and if I fast 2 hours, I get great autophagy, and if I fast 7 days, like the mice in the experiment. But, you know, all this data is based on mice experiments, and a mouse day and a human day are vastly different. So the reality is we know nothing about autophagy really. But what we do know is that having a sustainable eating routine that gets you to a healthy body fat composition, waist to height ratio is really, really important for so many things. And so really what you want to do is find a daily eating routine that enables you to achieve that and then maintain it. And we then encourage people to transition with data-driven fasting to a maintenance regime where they can have a higher blood sugar trigger and then practice maintaining their weight, which is often harder than losing weight. And then once you can actually learn to maintain your weight, understand the hunger level that will enable you to maintain your weight, you can then be free of tracking and then come back if you really needed to later. But yeah, that learning your own correlation of hunger sensations with your blood sugar and actual true hunger is really important.
And is that how you see the software, the Nutrient Optimizer software, as sort of training wheels? Like it?
Yeah, totally.
You know, when you meet a client and they've been tracking everything they've eaten for the last 10 years,
totally.
It kind of raises an eyebrow. You know? And I've definitely done it in the past and found great utility. And we do it with every client that walks in the door. Like, we're going to track your food for a couple of days so that we can see what you're eating. But yeah, to keep doing it indefinitely, like, seems a bit nutty. Surely, who keeps that up?
Yeah, we've got some people who have been tracking for years, but we definitely don't encourage that. And like you said, it's about training wheels. It's about recalibrating your diet for your needs and getting to a point where you've got, we talk about the optimal 30-30 foods and meals. So most people eat a fairly narrow selection of foods and meals. So once you find the ones that you're currently eating that work for you and a few new ones that work even better for you and eliminate the less than optimal ones, then you can have this selection of foods that you can go to most of the time to eat and enjoy. And you don't need to be tracking. You can get rid of the training wheels. You can get rid of the calorie tracking and the blood sugar machine, and you know what works for you. And then you look in the mirror one day and go, okay, it's a little bit out of range and I'm not feeling as great anymore. Let's go back and dial it in again. But yeah, we're both ex-biohackers, I think, that love to quantify everything, and numbers are amazing, but you don't really want to track everything forever, and life is about more than introspecting, navel gazing on your biometric data every day. That's not really life. You want to free people to live life after tracking, but tracking, you manage what you measure is really, really powerful, but eventually you've got to move on and live life and enjoy life.
Yeah. And I'd argue that we're all habitual creatures. You know, we all repeat the same behaviors over and over again every day. And those behaviors,
you've got to retrain those habits. And once you've retrained the habits,
that's why the training wheel analogy is quite a good one. Are there any nutrients that you find people just can't get enough of from food? You know, I still take a multivitamin religiously, and it's a good one. You know, it's not like one of the crap ones you get from Walgreens, obviously. But the reason I do that is I see most of the nutrients as like, there's either no known toxicity or very little risk. You know, you can make an argument that, you know, B6 neuropathy is a thing, but unless you're going really bonkers with an individual vitamin in one supplement, like, you're probably not going to do that with a multi. And I just wonder whether you think that's a wise decision based on the data that you've seen, or whether you can just optimize using your software and then skip the multivitamin.
Yeah, in the data-driven macros course, we train people to review their current food intake and say, do I really need all those supplements I was taking? And some people are going, oh, no, I don't. And I get $500 a month back in all the supplements that I no longer needed that I was taking for this belt and braces approach. So that's pretty exciting. I think if you're tracking your food and you find I'm not meeting the RDI, that recommended daily intake to prevent the diseases of deficiency, there's use in supplementing to some degree. But I think beyond that, you're not actually getting much benefit. And most people find they can get what they need from whole food unless they're maybe have an extreme diet, maybe extreme carnivore, extreme plant-based, where they're getting, they've eliminated food groups that could provide them with the nutrients that they need.
But what about things like vitamin C? You know, I know you've heard Malcolm
talk about
this,
great.
Right? Like if you've become, say you've got an elevation of Lp little a, you really don't want to become vitamin C deficient.
Yeah.
And there's not really any toxicity of vitamin C. It's like cheap as chips and maybe you give yourself diarrhea if you take 20 grams of it, but most people are never going to do that, right?
Yeah. That's the thing. If you're taking a lot of vitamin C, ascorbic acid or magnesium or potassium in the supplemental form, your gut will get to a point where it goes, I can't take any of this. So I don't know how much you want to do that. To actually get all the minerals you need on a daily basis from pills and powders, it's a lot of powder. And that's why packed into your little micronutrient multivitamin pill that you can take every day, because it's really fortification and multivitamins probably covered it off on a lot of the smaller nutrients. But it tends to be that the larger nutrients, the calcium, the potassium, magnesium, that we tend to really struggle to get enough of and have the higher satiety impact. So yeah, and then again, going back to the fortification, I'm not sure whether eating heavily fortified foods is a great idea from a satiety perspective, because you keep chowing down on those foods that provide the nutrients that your body needs, but other than the iron, B9 and B1 and B3 that have been fortified with, they're quite nutrient poor and low satiety, and you lose your appetite for the other foods that you probably actually needed to eat.
And how do you account for things like people's water? Do you think that, surely water is a meaningful source of calcium and magnesium. Our water here is really hard here in Santa Cruz. Like, it must make a difference. If you're drinking from, you've got a whole house filtration system, reverse osmosis or whatever, that's filtering out all of those minerals. You think that's going to make a difference? Or what do you think?
Maybe, maybe not. Some people, if they're trying to compete for the top of the leaderboard, start getting that mineral water that's got a bunch of calcium and magnesium in it. So people will then start tracking that and buying a whole lot of it in the final week where they're competing for the the top nutrient score. But yeah, most of the time, other than getting out optimal nutrient intake, you can get enough of it from food fairly easily.
Okay. And where do you get your optimal ranges from? Or do you just assume that more is better?
No, definitely not. It's definitely not more is better, and not to the point you need fortification and supplementation. So took the 125,000 days of data and then looked at the bell curve of the distribution of all the different nutrients. So you could see fairly clearly where people were getting massive amounts of vitamin D and massive amounts of iron or different nutrients that people tend to supplement. And I went through and culled all those days that were obviously containing fortified data. And so culled that down to from 125,000 days to 55,000 days. And then you can see the satiety response to each of those nutrients. Like, say, if you plot percentage protein, for example, versus calories, you can see quite a clear satiety response curve, which is fairly linear. Then when you look at some other nutrients, like you talked about vitamin C, you get to about 300 milligrams per 2000 calories and it starts to level out. The same thing happens with a number of other nutrients, particularly the B vitamins. You get enough and it just seems your body starts to tap out and not crave any more of the foods to contain those nutrients. So we sort of decided that inflection point was the optimal nutrient intake, or the 85th percentile intake, which is sort of the amount that only 15% of that 55,000 days worth of data, where those people were getting more of that. So it's sort of a stretch target, but still achievable with whole food and within the amount that seems to provide a satiety benefit. So that's how we calculated the optimal nutrient intake, and we say, you know, go at it and try to achieve that. And you need to get 100% of the optimal nutrient intake across all 34 essential micronutrients to get our optimal nutrient intake score up to 100. So when you put that carrot in front of people, get really excited about going, okay, I thought I had a nutrient dense diet, and let's see where I rank and what do I need to fill that in. And yeah, so that becomes really fun when you gamify it with quantification.
You made me think of a couple of things. I'll come back to, ask me again about the loser avoidance bias. We have to talk about that at some point. The thing that I was thinking about first.
That's a fascinating rabbit hole.
Yeah. What about iron? Like, so we see lots of clients with iron overload, and I might include myself in those, where I just tend to become iron overloaded over time, eating the type of diet that we've been talking about up until now. I come to the conclusion that periodic blood donation was the way to manage that, rather than avoiding iron-rich foods. But do you take any account for that? I think you probably don't need to, but I'm just wondering if you thought about
it. Yeah, I donated blood on Monday, and that's a really good idea and probably the most effective way of doing it. But with iron-rich food, I mean, there's a degree where a healthy body is able to detoxify the liver and the iron through the liver. And fortification, I think, is providing a lot of iron in the diet at the moment. So I think you're not probably having a lot of fortified foods. I think lot of people
none at are, all. And the multivitamin doesn't generally have The kids' multivitamin has iron, but not none of the ones that we're recommending for clients, and not the one I take has got iron in it.
But I think iron, fortified iron, is probably providing a lot of people's
globally, it's a huge problem, right? Iron deficiency is a massive problem globally, but where we are in the US, not so much, I don't
think. Yeah, but if you've, that's probably the first thing, is to eliminate iron fortified foods from your diet. But what in Nutrient Optimizer, you can tick the box to say, yeah, I want to de-emphasize iron. But at the same time, once you start de-emphasizing one nutrient, all the other nutrient density
comes along for the ride,
through the floor, and you end up with, you know, here's your oil that's got no nutrients at all because you selected, I want to avoid iron. So what Nutrient Optimizer does, once you've got enough iron in your diet based on your food logging, it won't emphasize that. So rather than trying to actively avoid it, you're prioritizing the other nutrients that you need more of. And implicit in that, you're not going to overemphasize iron anymore.
And so is that true then as well for, say, copper and zinc? Like if you're eating whole foods, you probably don't need to worry about the ratio between the two. It's really only when you get into isolated supplements could you create an imbalance. And of course, copper toxicity is a thing. So I've said that more is better. Like, it's not, I found two rules already, like copper and iron, where more is not necessarily better.
And that's one of the challenges. It's not vitamin A toxicity from liver. I think it's, you know, you can actually get too much copper quite easily from excess liver. And again, with Nutrient Optimizer, if any of those ratios are out of balance, you're not going to emphasize more sodium, for example, if your potassium-sodium ratio is out. So you automatically drop off those nutrients to prioritize once, if the ratios are out. But to do that manually without, it blows your mind. So yeah, you have to use sort of a system or program to do it because it's actually really hard to balance all those ratios all at once.
So is there an entry in the database for Chronometer for polar bear liver? Will I win your competition with polar bear liver all the time?
We haven't had that question because not a lot of Arctic explorers who are dehydrated and have to eat polar bear liver and their dogs. But I think that's one of the rare cases that have been documented for hypervitaminosis.
I bet you could get it from eating grizzly bear liver as well. Grizzly bears and polar bears are basically the same animal, right? So there's lots of grizzly bears in America still.
But do you have to be dehydrated to get that effect? It's debatable. I don't know. Anyway, yeah, no, most people, it's amazing how low the recommended daily intake, the dietary reference intake for vitamin A is. It's crazy low compared to what is achievable from an omnivorous diet. It's through the floor.
Okay. And then, so, all right, final hard question then. The loser avoidance bias.
Yeah.
And my understanding is that, so it can go both ways. Like what you said with the gamification of this thing. It could be that I log in and see I'm doing really well on this leaderboard and I think I'm encouraged, right? But then the opposite might be true too. I might log in and see, oh, actually, I thought my great diet is actually pretty shit and I'm nowhere on this leaderboard. And then I may not come back ever again. And I think, you know, as the name suggests, this has been seen in other applications and it's something to think about when designing a piece of software. So I'm just wondering if you thought about it.
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge. Human psyche is more interesting and more challenging. it's just fascinating to see how different people will react to quantification of the nutrient density. And it's really exciting when a lot of people say, yeah, here's a challenge. I've got to, you know, I've just smashed my Strava King of the Mountain. I'm now going to try and unbalance my heart rate variability with Elite HRV, which I'm back doing now to calm myself down after hearing you talk about it a lot. But it's really helpful.
The stress,
but
you mean?
Yeah, yeah. Just calm down. But there's definitely people who say, oh, this is all too hard and I've got so much to go to catch up. And that's why we've had the masterclass for 3 years and now I've broken it into, I'm just rewriting the whole thing at the moment, into data-driven macros and data-driven micros. So for people coming from data-driven fasting who don't really know what a protein, fat and carb is yet, they don't want to be competing with all these other people are saying, let's sun our mushrooms and drink mineral water to get our nutrient density up more. They can just start with the small steps. So yeah, there's definitely an element of let's just to reveal the puzzle one step at a time rather than jumping in the rabbit hole and being overwhelmed, because nutrition's a fascinating, interesting puzzle, but it can be overwhelming if you try to do everything all at once. And it's just a matter of going, here's one thing to do this week. That's enough. Nail that. Get enough protein. Next week, how's your fat intake? Let's dial that down. Next week, how are your blood sugars? Do you need to worry about carbs, or do you need to drop them, or you can just get on with focusing on nutrient density?
That's great. Do you still run the Optimizing Nutrition Facebook group? You know, when I dumped Facebook a couple of years ago, I think I've thrown the baby out with the bathwater there, but is it still going?
A little bit. We had wonderful heydays 6 years ago when we all learned a hell of a lot and were asking a whole lot of interesting questions. We had a great group of people. That one's not so active, but we've got a few other groups with,
okay,
you know, NutriBooster recipes and a data-driven fasting group. And okay, yeah, it's interesting how some communities, anything in nutrition can become quite
heated
and divisive. And yeah, so we just try to create supportive communities where people can go, yeah, here's my issue and let me help you. And sometimes starting with the basics, like you said, is better than always trying to out-nerd each other with the latest scientific paper.
Well, this has been great. Tell people where they can find the Nutrient Optimizer software and also the masterclass that you mentioned. I like the idea of having you or someone that understands the software really well walk me through it, because, I don't know, software
to
and food together is like quite a combination for...
Yeah, we're starting another challenge on the Data-Driven Macros Challenge on the 8th of January. So I'd love you to jump in and have a play and give us some more feedback. But check out nutrientoptimizer.com or optimizingnutrition.com or Google Data-Driven Fasting if you wanted to use your blood sugar to guide your eating routine without tracking calories, which not everybody wants to do.
Okay, that's great. And I understand that you've been in the podcast world for a while now as well. Tell people where you can find your podcast. What's it called?
Just Optimizing Nutrition Podcast, and I'm just having fun chatting to people like yourself and a whole bunch of cool people who I've admired and been friends with for a long time, but also just people who just have done the challenge, and I want to hear their journey and just share their tips from their journey. So yeah, Optimizing Nutrition Podcast.
Excellent.
Check it out.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate all the hard work that you've done over the years and taking the time to talk to me today. Thank you.
Great to have your friendship. Thanks, Chris. Keep up the great work.